It is very hard for me to trust people, and I'm not a person with trust issues in that, like, I think people are gonna like hurt me or take things from me. When I say trust, I generally come from a place of not believing that people have the capacity to really like understand me on an emotional, spiritual, intellectual level. So when I thought about just having to process through, you know, blackness and what it meant to be black, in my mind, there is no one who hadn't like walked the path that could really understand the way I understood it, you know, because there's like the academic approach of, you know, I'm culturally competent, I understand, but then there's also the like, girl, I get it approach.
That was my guest on today's show, Kiara Amani Williams, and we're talking about her book, Therapy Isn't Just for White People. Stay tuned for part two of our discussion.
Into Relationships and You, hosted by Toby Jenkins, a licensed marriage and family therapist serving Central Kentucky. Each week, Toby will bring you a show with a topic related to mental health, relationships, or self-improvement. The name of the show, Paradigm, comes from that moment in the therapy process when a profound shift in perspective happens for a client. An epiphany, sometimes accompanied by physical reaction that leads them to look at things differently and make significant steps towards improving and enriching their lives.
And we are back. You are listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Today, my guest is Kiara Amani Williams, and we're talking about her upcoming book, Therapy Just Isn't for White People. You know, there are multiple barriers to walk into a professional's office, a therapist, psychologist, social work counselor. And so I often get, especially with people, this is their first experience and they're really reluctant to come in and talk to me in the first place. And they have these expectations of what this experience is going to be like. So I tell first time clients, we're just having a conversation. So what was it like for you starting this process, like in the room itself? What was that like?
Yeah. It was interesting. Like, I think I'm a very analytical person. And if I'm honest, like a lot of what I knew about therapy had just like been from television. So I like remember walking into the room and being like, okay, there's a couch. I know I'm supposed to sit on the couch and you'll sit there and you'll write things down and like nod your head and I'll talk and you'll ask me questions. Like I had that idea just because that's what I've seen on television. Right. I wasn't sure if I was gonna like lay on the couch. Like, do I lay? Or do I like sit here? I remember being like kind of cold and she had like a blanket in the office and I was like, can I use that? I'm cold. And she was like, yeah. So I like kind of like bundled up on the couch and just sat like I was hanging out with one of my girlfriends. So it just felt like I made myself very at home. I was like, all right, I'm going to be comfortable. Like I'm paying for this session. I'm going to make myself at home. What do I need to feel comfortable?
That's right. You're paying for it.
Yeah. And so like she had like really great like aromatherapy stuff. I think she had a lavender that was like really nice and like two candles up and stuff. So it just felt like homey, like I was hanging out with a friend. I didn't like it at first. And I don't know that I'm like other people where it was because I was afraid, because I didn't really have fear. Maybe a little bit of like, I don't know if you've heard of Brene Brown. She calls about like FFTs or like effing first times. Like that.
I
like
love Brene Brown. I have a quick story to tell you. I turned my wife on to Brene Brown. She'd never heard of Brene Brown. And then like a week later, she was at this conference and guess who the keynote speaker was? Brene Brown. So she goes up on stage and takes a picture with Brene Brown and sends it to me. I was pissed. I was like, I've been telling you about Brene Brown forever And then the next week you get to meet her. It's just not fair. Listen, I'm a big fan of Brene Brown and her work.
Sometimes life just isn't fair. It's just how it works, you know?
I know.
But yeah, it was a first time. So I definitely had like my first time, like, what the heck is going on moment. But I wasn't afraid necessarily, if anything. And I think a lot of this for me has been, I'll say it's a mixture of like ego and wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think it can be very foolish to trust people with all of you without like building trust with the person first. Sure. Because, you know, they could use whatever you're sharing to like hurt you, harm you. They might not carry it well. They might not respond well. My aunt used to always tell me when I was younger, like, you don't have to talk to anybody. They don't know you. You don't have to trust people with you. Like, you don't, it's a big deal to like share yourself with someone. And so you don't have to do that. So yes. I think I've always been kind of like very wise in that regard. But I say it was mixed with some ego because I also had the idea like who knows me better than me? Like how is this random person that has not like, grown up with me and like sat with my story and my experience every day gonna tell me something about myself that I don't already know? And I remember like my first session sitting with my therapist, her name was Alex, and I was like, listen, I know a lot of other people probably come in here because they're like lost and broken, but like, I'm not those things. Like I come from a nuclear family, I had a great childhood. Like we don't need to talk about my past at all because it in no way is affecting who I am today. Like I'm just like dealing with some anxiety and trying to figure out some things about life. So I just want to talk about that. Like we don't need to talk about the past. And I really, like, I thought that, like, that was the right way. And she didn't tell me I was wrong. And, you know, she did ask me some questions about childhood. But I remember, like, a couple of sessions down the road, she's like, you know, you mentioned, like, coming from a great family. And you mentioned all this stuff about you don't need to talk about your past. And, you know, I asked you about your mom. You're like, nope, no issues. Dad, nope, no issues. You know, you just denied that you have any family issues, which is great. But a lot of what you're talking about in relationship sounds like you felt like you were supposed to be married at an early age. Do you think the fact that your parents were married at an early age like affected your worldview in that capacity? And I was like, oh my God. I think that's where I started learning that like trauma isn't always like a bad thing. Like a little trauma could just be something that changes the way that you see the world. Absolutely. And my parents have a very healthy relationship. So I thought, if they have, there's no way that a relationship can affect you if it was healthy. Like I saw healthy love. So how could I be affected by that? But then there's all this other stuff, like maybe pressure to have a relationship that's like just as good or to make it look the same or, you know, all these other things that like come from that. So she really helped me like just see my past differently. Cause no one wants to like, you know, my mom was problematic or my dad was problematic. Some people actually had that experience, but if you feel like you had like loving kind parents, it feels almost like a betrayal to be like something that you did affected me, and it's sometimes it's not their fault, you know.
No, not at all. You know, you have a good therapist, and you know, one of the value of having this third person outside of your norm is because they see it with fresh eyes. And you've been looking at the same thing all your life, and this other person sees it very differently. You know, that reminds me of, you know, my parents have been married over 50 something years, and I don't have any memories of seeing them argue or fight. And so talking about, you know, this is something I tell a lot of my clients. And when I got married, my wife grew up with parents who run a business together. And so there was always back and forth conflict and resolving conflict. And so when we got married, we had two different models of how this looked. And the first time I got confronted, well, actually not the first time, but the first couple of times I freaked out. I was like, married people don't argue. Cause my parents went to their room. I knew something magical happened. Then they come out. And so, so it's an example. And I think for my parents' sake, I think they were doing what they thought was best for us. Not having open conflict in front of us, but, I didn't know how to handle conflict in my marriage when I first got married. And so, yeah, and those are the kind of things that you, like you said, they're pleasant memories, but then having someone trained and someone who work, this is what they do, offers really good insight. And so sounds like your therapist, and I, you know, half, more than half of being a good therapist is listening.
Yeah.
And then I would say a good chunk of it outside of your training is that in a lot of ways, being an observer of processes. And so, you know, I think I mentioned before we got on, that my specialty are relationships and couples. But in particular, infidelity. And so at any given time, half of my couples are working through some infidelity. And so I know what recovery looks like from a process standpoint. Yeah. And so it can be very tricky, especially right in the moment or fresh off of discovering, observing and letting couples know, this is the process you're about to go through. I mean, that's the advantage of working with someone who does this. So your therapist has probably observed this a lot of times, right?
Yeah.
Because therapists are also students of behavior.
It's so interesting, therapy too. Like, I'm like a very, like, if you don't have fruit in this area, are you someone I need to listen to? And again, a lot of that comes from wisdom. Like, if you're trying to tell me how to build a business and you haven't like built a business that's sustainable, like, I'm like, no, you don't have fruit in that area. Mm. Or like your friends that are in terrible relationships all the time that like want to give you advice. And I'm like, you are the last person I want to talk to. I found myself with therapy. It's hard because there wasn't really a space for me to get to know my therapist. Like, I almost wish that we could have like that it was like an exchange. Like, I wanted to know more about her. Like, you're giving me relationship advice, but like, are you taking it? Like, what does your life look like? Has it worked for you? Like, those are I wanted to ask those questions, but I was like, it's not a space for me to do that. But I actually ended up finding my therapist like after I stopped going regularly. It actually got to the point where my therapist was like, look, you can keep coming every week if you want to, but I've already given you the tools that you need. And so at this point, like, I feel like you're good. Like, you could come back when you want to process something. And I was like, oh, okay. But I ended up finding her later on Instagram and saw that she was engaged. And I feel like, not that it shouldn't matter, but it almost like validated a lot of what she told me. Because I was like, oh, you have fruit. So it was like really hard for me to divorce myself from like wanting to know her.
That we'll have to talk about that a little more after the break, because from a good part of the therapeutic relationship is indeed a relationship. That gets to be kind of blurred and tricky. Like, how much do you self-disclose as a therapist? And it varies by therapist. Now, I am probably more of a self-disclosure kind of therapist than others. And so it's very nuanced. It's a little more art than science. But, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned like kind of ending the therapy. And I want to ask you maybe after the break, because ending a therapeutic relationship or finishing, so to speak, is also very tricky. And there's some known things that happen when that working relationship is getting ready to end or termination is happening. And so we'll talk about some of those phenomenon. The biggest one is that all of a sudden all these problems come back that you came to therapy for. So let's talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Today, my guest is Kiera Imani-Williams, and we're talking about going to therapy. And she's the author of the forthcoming book, Therapy Isn't Just for White People. We'll be right back. This is Toby Jenkins, founder of Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy and host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy is a proud sponsor and supporter of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. At Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy, we work with couples, families, and individuals walking with you through life's challenges and transitions. You can find out more about Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy and request an appointment through telehealth or in person at www.jenkinscft.com or by calling 859-806-6000. 0093. And we are back. You are listening to Paradigm Insights into Relationships and You. Today, my guest is Kiara Amani Williams, and we're talking about the therapy process. And so she's the author of a book coming out this spring, Therapy Isn't Just for White People. And so a lot of what we're doing today is demystifying the therapy process. So there's not, I don't know, whatever the conceptions are. I know people are very fearful to step foot into a therapy office, especially if you're a person of color, because historically that has meant that there's something wrong with you or you are crazy. So, you know, you were describing before the break that your therapist initiated a conversation around, you know, you've gotten all the tools you need to do the things you want to do. Now, I recognize that as termination. And so from a therapy standpoint, there's always a point where your client gets to where they want to go, and the relationship ends, the therapy relationship ends. And so that can look like a number of different things. A lot of therapists will recommend like spacing out sessions and maybe going into more of a maintenance mode. If something comes up, come back in. But for many clients, getting out of therapy can be almost as scary as starting therapy. And so there've been some very interesting studies around suddenly when this termination process starts up, then some of the presenting problems come back, there are reasons. So it can be very difficult to end the relationship. So for you, when your therapist said, "Hey, I think you're good here," did that produce more anxiety or stress for you?
No, it's very interesting. So first of all, we kind of had like two endings. Like I was going to therapy for a little bit and then I decided I don't need this anymore. So I kind of told her like, "Hey, you know, I'm switching jobs. I have a lot of life change going on. I don't really think I need therapy anymore. It's been great. Thanks for the help." That didn't go so well.
You broke up with your therapist. That sucks when people do that.
Really good at breaking up with people, what I learned in therapy, for better or for worse. So I felt great about the breakup. But I was back within a month and a half. I was like, I wasn't ready to let go. So the second time we got to the point where she was kind of like, "You know, I think we're good." I'm very like achievement oriented. Like I love achieving things. So it almost felt like someone was putting like a gold star on my paper. Like I almost wanted like an A plus or like a graduating diploma thing so I could like put it on my fridge. And I was like telling everybody, like my therapist said, I don't need to go back. Like I'm good.
I'm good, y'all.
I think it felt really good to just have somebody else like validate that I was in a good space, because I felt like I was in a good space. And she told me to, like, "You're very self-aware," which I really loved. And I think I'm also a little bit different than other people in that, like, I was in a lot of ways, I'm a difficult patient. I was like, really? psychologically maybe analyzing my therapist's process, like while she was like psychoanalyzing me, which I like process and knowing process and like how we would start our sessions, the type of questions that she would ask. So it was really good, because when I did get into moments of being like, "Okay, I need to process through something," I like had the tools and the process, because I'm like, "All right, well, I would do this with Alex." And then she would ask me these types of questions. And then I would respond. She would ask me a why question, a follow-up, and I would respond. Mm-hmm. So I almost kind of learned to be my own therapist after therapy. Not to say that, like, you know, if I have another bigger life trauma or something specific that I want to process, that I wouldn't go back, because I definitely would. But on a day-to-day level, I felt really like equipped to just like go in the world. So it was a great like mutual breakup.
Oh, that's really good. You know, it's interesting when you I use the word breakup. It's a termination. You know, I guess it's a termination when your therapist initiates it. It's probably a breakup when the client initiates it. You know, there's some similarities. I was talking to one of my pastors back in Nashville, and there's some similarities between how relationships end at church and in therapy. And so it was funny because our church in Nashville, when we moved, we came back for a visit, and it was, we were recognized like, hey, Toby and Nicole are back. And my pastor said, you know, most people don't leave the church like this. They're usually mad or pissed off. And yeah. So from a therapy standpoint, and this is kind of giving you perspective from the other side, is that I'd probably say at least half the clients you see, you don't know what happens to them, because a lot of people just drop out. They just stop coming, which goes back to what I was saying earlier. At any given time, there's probably someone who came to see me sitting in front of somebody else saying, yeah, that Toby was horrible. He didn't help me at all, right? And so it's nice when you get to see the person grow and find out what happens after. But I would say for most therapists, it's not a large percentage of their clients, and people just kind of drop out and disappear. Kind of like what you said earlier, you gave your therapist a call. A lot of people just don't call. They just stop coming. But the termination process can be very anxiety producing, because now you've got to take these tools you've learned in therapy and implement them. And so and then there's also kind of the relationship part. So did you went weekly to your therapist for a while?
It depended on like the month. Like sometimes it was weekly, sometimes it was like every other week. Towards the end, it was more spaced out. So like every 3 weeks or once a month. Okay. So yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Did you miss her?
I don't know if miss is the right word. Like there aren't a lot of people that I miss. Like I moved around a lot when I was little. So I have like really good, and like, I feel like we can like love each other from a distance. Okay. About her, like I'm like, oh, I wonder what Alex is doing. And I think also because I'm like generally like the helper in my relationships, like I'm the strong friend, I'm the one everybody turns to, even though I knew that, like paying for her for sessions and it was about me, there's like always a piece of me that wants to be like, well, if you want someone to like process with, like I'm here, like you can talk to me. I can talk to you. So, like not doing that with her was like hard, but I do think about it sometimes.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's the nature of the therapeutic relationship is, you know, the emphasis, it's a relationship. And, you know, from my side of the table, of the couch or the table, I do get attached to clients. And it's kind of hard not to, because sharing so much of someone's life and seeing them improve, or, you know, sharing pain with them is a very bonding experience. And so it is a gray line. I mean, there are people that I've seen that I don't see anymore, and I was like, man, I kind of miss seeing them every week. So when you have a good therapist, that bond part, it's the bond. That bond part is really important.
I had to like not let it get too serious, because again, like I said, she was psychoanalyzing me, but because I knew that she was doing that, I was psychoanalyzing her. Like little thing, like I remember going into her office one time, I don't remember what my hairstyle was, but she commented when I walked in, oh, I like your hairstyle. And I was like, thanks. Now a normal non over analytical person would accept that as a compliment, like, oh, Alex likes my hair. But for me, I was like, I think my hair was straight before. Now it's braided. Is she trying to like tell me that she wants to wear like more black style? Is she saying that I have a problem with like my blackness? And like now she's trying to affirm me so that I continue to do it? Or like I was making everything so deep. What is your outcome? Why did you say that? And just, and maybe any of those things could have been true. Maybe none of them were true, but that wasn't the point, like the session. So it was like, it was that hard for me funny. Not to like analyze back.
Yeah, you know, I would say from a therapy standpoint, I would not find that difficult to work with. The most difficult clients for me to work with are people that have some training, or they are therapists or in the mental health field themselves, because they this is the advantage. So there are certain tools I have at my disposal. And if you don't know they're coming, then they work a lot better than you say, oh, that's a CBT question. And then it's like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the person will say, I don't like CBT. And I'm like, well crap. Well, so my most difficult clients are those that are either have some training, or I occasionally get clients who are what I would call consumers of therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I occasionally get clients who come in and say, I want this kind of therapy for this many weeks. And so now I'm fortunate that I'm in a private practice setting. And so I can kind of tell if it's not going to work or maybe I'm not the right fit. And so, those are the most difficult, because now the training you get is, and like I said earlier, a lot of it's about listening, understanding, input, repeating back and empathizing and maybe offering a new viewpoint. But if the person knows it's coming, it's harder. You get more resistance. And so now I have some other tricks up my sleeve when there's resistance. And usually we talk about the resistance, like, hey, who's controlling the therapy here, kind of a thing. But anyway, we're up against another break. That was a fast segment. That just went by, flew by. You are listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Today we're talking about the therapeutic process, going to therapy, and my guest is Kiera Amani Williams. She's the author of the book, Therapy Isn't Just for White People. We'll be right back after this break. This is Toby Jenkins, host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You, and this is Woman in Insight. There are multiple overlaps between extreme bias and prejudice and mental health. One in particular is the activation of the fight, flight, or freeze response. From an evolutionary standpoint, it's believed that this response in us was a survival strategy for us to quickly evaluate a threat and take appropriate action. Physiologically, there are a lot of things going on to enable us to do that. And one of the key hormones that's released during this activation is cortisol, otherwise known as the stress hormone. And we've learned in more recent studies that constant exposure to cortisol has damaging effects not only in our physical health, but our mental health. And there are strong correlations between this exposure to cortisol and diabetes, hypertension, obesity from a chronic physical standpoint, and with depression and anxiety from a mental health standpoint. This is Toby Jenkins, host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. One of the biggest stressors that we encounter is money. Money issues strain our family life, create stress in our relationships, and can provoke serious anxiety and depression. And many don't know where to turn to get relief. That's where the Darius Norman Show comes in. The Darius Norman Show airs daily on WTTA FM 101.2 from 1 to 2 p.m. Darius Norman is a certified credit and financial counselor and author of Rewriting Financial Rules. It's his objective to empower others with educational tools and services to assist them in taking control of their financial and credit issues. Tune in to the Darius Norman Show on WTTA FM 101.2, and you can follow him on Twitter at the Darius Norman Show. We are back. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Today, my guest is Kiera Amani Williams. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Therapy Isn't Just for White People. Now, I've made this statement a couple times on my show, and as a way of holding myself somewhat accountable, but I have not done this yet. I too would love to write a book. And I've had several authors on my show, and I'm always amazed at their process. One of my previous guests in retirement just decided, I'm gonna start writing books. And so he's been writing nonfiction books and self-publishing. So how did you go about getting a book deal? And what does that look like for you? And you know, the average author out there wants to write a book.
Yeah, so I mean, with self-publishing, there's so many options available now. I just personally don't really enjoy like all the marketing stuff. Like I didn't want to have to worry about process. Like I am a trained entertainment attorney and actually works for a company where we worked a lot with like product, and like I just didn't want to have to deal with all of that, like me sending out the book, or if you do it on Amazon, they take a huge percentage. I think there are incredible things about self-publishing, like getting to own your manuscript. So if you're a person who's like willing to do that work and you're confident that you can sell the copies, like I say, go for it 100%. But I actually, originally wanted to write a fiction book. I was working on like a sci-fi young adult trilogy.
Nice.
But with black characters. So think like Harry Potter meets like Black Panther. Meets like this is
yeah.
future past situation, and was working on that book. Loved like the concept, and still very committed to finishing it. But one of my mentors is actually a New York Times bestseller. Was like, you know, if you do want a traditional therapist publisher, it's a lot easier to break into publishing in the nonfiction space than fiction space. It's a lot easier to win awards. It's because the less people are doing it, actually publishing, it's a lot easier to get notoriety. So, and obviously it's much easier to get a second publishing deal after you already get a first one. Wow. So I kind of went to, I was at a conference and she did like a class on like how to, you know, set yourself up and get a publishing deal to kind of like build your brand. So I went to the class, and she like, you know, gave us some tools as to like what needed to be in a book proposal, told us, you know, the types of things that we needed to include, the research that we needed to do. She told us like what we should write about, not specifically, but she was just like, you know, what is something that's like defining to like who you are and your story? What's so integrated with you that a publisher is going to be like, nobody else can write this the way that you can write this because of your experience, looking at our stories and not seeing them as like, this is boring. Like it might be boring to us because we're familiar with them. We're looking at them every day. But you know, what are the things that other people will look at in your life and be like, oh, that's interesting. So she gave us this advice. So I went home because I'm like a very like, let's get it done person.
Yeah.
And then like, hey, so I wrote my 40-page book proposal. Can you take a look at it before I send it out? And she was like, wait a second.
Wait, prior to this, did you have experience writing like that?
I've been blogging forever. Like I started blogging. I had my own blog in college. I started blogging for Huffington Post at like 21, 22.
Okay.
So I had done a lot of like short form writing. I did written TV reviews. Like I've really been writing since I was little. I used to journal a lot. So writing has always felt very natural. Now writing like a full like book obviously is very different.
It's a different animal, yeah.
Which I'm learning and experiencing right now. But with the book proposal, it was more like short form writing. It's like, you know, a couple pages of marketing plan, couple pages on like why me, couple pages on my bio. So that felt very familiar and easy. So putting that together for me was like a breeze. It was actually like finding my publisher and like working through my proposal to figure out what I was actually trying to say, then figuring out how to turn it into like long form content. That process has been interesting because I have to sit with it. Like with when you're writing an article, you know, every paragraph you hit a new point, boom, boom, boom. You don't have to like dive in. But with a book, you have the word count in the space. So a story doesn't have to be a paragraph. It can be 10 pages. It's like sitting with it and like paying attention to the details has been interesting. And like in terms of process, if anyone else is thinking about writing a book, like for fiction and nonfiction are very different, but if you're thinking about a nonfiction book, there are lots of templates online. Putting together a book proposal is really important, whether you choose to self-publish or not. It kind of just gives you a roadmap for like, you know, where am I going with this book? What's my audience, competition? It's almost like a business plan for a business. Right. And then once you have that proposal, you can kind of use it to kind of guide your own publishing process or start, you know, looking at publishers that published in your genre and like sending it out, seeing what happens.
Wow. And so, so the book you're working on now, Therapy Isn't Just for White People, it will have your experience in it, but will also have others. And so experiences of other people, is that correct?
And so, yeah. So it's a lot of my story. Well, I would say it's all my experience because a lot of it is like stories that people have told me or comments that I've had through my podcast. So it's just things that like, there are other people's stories integrated through like how it affected me and how it made me see things differently. So I'm not the only voice in the book, but it's very like narrative form. Like I want people to kind of like read through it and laugh, and it's very relaxed. I try to speak in like colloquial English as much as possible. Like I didn't want it to be this like academic piece talking about like therapy. Like it's a lot more heart than it is head. Very little head. It's a lot of heart. So it's been fun to like just put that together.
Yeah. Now, I've been given the short form of the title of your book, but it's about living with the trauma of having a Black experience in this country. So, you know, with the recent events and the protests, how, you know, is that playing a role in the material you put in your book, or how's that working? That's a goofy question.
Yeah.
How's this affecting this process of writing this book right now?
It's interesting because at a certain point, like I've already kind of turned in the outline. So these are the things I want to talk about, but it's always slightly changing. And I feel like every single day I wake up and something new has happened. And I'm like, oh, I want to incorporate that. Oh, I want to talk about that. So I'm just trying to find balance, like allowing myself, if I really feel like it's natural to integrate into a chapter I already have, I'm doing that. But otherwise I'm trying not to like rewrite, because I could just keep rewriting forever and like never have a product to release.
Yeah. You know, that's funny. I had a poet on my show earlier in the season, and I compared writing poetry, because I don't write poetry and I enjoy reading it. And I compared it to something I do enjoy creating, which is like construction projects. Like I like building things, DIY kind of thing. And there's always this feeling of completeness, like, yes, I did that. And I asked her about that, and she kind of said something very similar. For her, it's never really finished, but she knows she has to finish it. And so there's kind of this, I almost interpret as kind of a let down kind of feeling, like it could be more perfect, but I have to put a pin in it, kind of a thing.
I mean, a lot of authors actually end up releasing first edition, second edition, third edition, because they go back and add something or change something, or I didn't like something about the first edition, or the cover was off, or they want a new board, whatever. So I think for a lot of writers, it's always a common understanding that the work is actually never finished. It's just ready to share.
Yeah. You know, something I've asked the other authors I've interviewed is, especially going through this process of writing a nonfiction book, in what unexpected ways has this writing this book changed you?
I don't know if it's necessarily changing me, but I think it's allowing me to tap into skills that I had that I didn't know I had. And it's also like stretching and pushing other skills that I like were a little weaker, like the patience piece. I feel like it's pushing me and like patience. I think because I'm telling a lot of stories, a lot of my family stories, it's actually forced me to kind of get on the phone with like my grandparents and just like actually listen to some of their old stories, because usually I'm like, oh, here we go, granddad's telling them. So when I called my granddad, my dad's dad, to like, and my mom's dad, both of them were so excited. And they both talked my ear off for like hours. And they were just so excited that I was like intentionally listening to them.
Yes.
Dad's dad, he actually had cancer and then some medical issues and heart attack and was in the hospital for a while. He's okay. And he said to me on the phone, like, I'm so glad that you're like incorporating my story into your story. story. And like, I keep thinking like, maybe this is why God brought me through all of that, just so that you could like get it out before I like left. So that was like a really cool like thing to hear, you know?
That is, yeah, that is so cool. I mean, I said it before, I would love to, I plan that. All right, I'm going to commit. I'm going to write a book. And I think the coolest thing about writing a book is just seeing it in a bookstore or imagining that other people are reading it and that it's touching lives and such in a meaningful way. And so, yeah, this is really cool. I'm looking forward to reading it. now you brought up something. We're heading into a break. You have, just when I was reading your bio, I was like, oh my gosh, that's a lot of talent you have. So you went out to LA as an entertainment attorney. So I think your jump to the things you're doing now would be very informative for my listeners. So I want to talk about that when we get back. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. My guest today is Kiara Amani Williams, and she's the author of Therapy Isn't Just for White People. We'll be right back.
You've got mail.
Today's listener mail comes from Laura. Laura writes, I've been seeing a therapist for about a year. I think my husband and I need marriage therapy. My husband does not want to go to my therapist because he thinks it would be two against one. Is he being unreasonable? I think my therapist would be perfectly fair for us. What would you tell Laura?
I would tell Laura that I completely understand where her husband is coming from. I don't necessarily know that it's about like two people being on one side, but I think that there's something special about like co-creating something together or experiencing something for the first time together. And so if he's walking into a situation where she's already comfortable, you know, she's already built trust, and he the only person that's not part of the trust circle, there might be a feeling of like not wanting to, you know, indulge the same way. Or like, I think it's the same thing when people get married, where it's like, I can move into your spot, or you can move into my spot, or we can just get a new spot together. I don't know that like one way is right or one way is wrong. I think it really depends on personality. But because I like being a part of the process, I would want to like pick a therapist together, you know, decide together and start that new chapter together.
Wow, you're good. And I thought I could throw you off by... So yeah, Laura, I agree with Kiara, and it's probably best to find a new therapist together and begin the process together. And I would even go so far as to recommend that you consider suspending your individual therapy during that time. One of my pet peeves, or one of the things that makes therapy difficult, especially with couples, is if everybody has their own therapist. So it's like there are five people in a room. And so I've even had extreme examples where individual therapists, and they're working for their client, but they're telling their client to do things that are counter to what's good for the couple. So I had this example where the boyfriend's therapist was saying, well, if she texts you more than four times an hour, you block her. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, you can't block someone you say you want to marry. You can't do, I mean, that's, so anyway. So Laura, I think your husband's right here. Find a therapist that works for both of you and consider suspending your individual therapists, and hope this advice from Kiara and I helps you out. Thank you.
Do you want to help positively transform schools? Then let me, Joel Cotty, keynote speaker and facilitator of the professional learning, Ignite, hashtag love in schools, put deep passion, purpose, and joy back into your classrooms, hallways, and school events. Share my contact information with a principal or district leader near you. My phone number is 859-967-8510, and find me on Twitter and Facebook at Ignite Love PD.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back with more Paradigm. Insights into Relationships and You with Toby Jenkins.
We're back. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. I'm your host, Toby Jenkins, and today my guest is Kiara Amani Williams. And so, so reading your bio, you have a lot of talents, and your path to doing the things that you are doing is not traditional. So you have a law degree from the University of Virginia, and you were practicing entertainment law while you started this process of doing a book proposal. Those seem like, from the outside looking in, two widely, vastly different skill sets. So and you're not doing entertainment law now. So how did you make that jump, and how did you decide, I'm not going to do entertainment law anymore? How did you do that?
Yeah. So, I never really started practicing law thinking that I was just going to be a lawyer forever. It was like, I talked a little bit about it in my book, but just as a Black woman who wanted respect, who wanted a certain level of like knowledge, who wanted to have a professional degree, law school made the most sense, because I was like, I can go to law school, but also I know so many incredible lawyers, you know, from like Angela Rye to Michelle Obama, who were like just doing all types of things. Angela Rye is a lawyer, right? Sometimes you just forget what people even do, because they're like, I just know so many people who are like, oh, I do this, 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 also I have my legal degree. So that was kind of like my foundation. So it didn't feel crazy to me when I was like, I'm just going to take another path. Because even now, having my own business, like I do all my own stuff. Like I registered my own LLC. I can do copyright. I can trademark. I can look at my own contracts. Like I'm equipped to like help myself in like the legal field. People usually think about like helping other people with their stuff, and I'm like, no, I'm helping myself with my stuff. But the transition for me also felt natural, because as an entertainment attorney, a lot of what I was doing was like working with our in-house, whoever, I worked at several different places, creative artists, agency, PDS, but a lot of what I was doing was like managing expectations and like talking to managers and agents and kind of trying to like get people who disagree to like agree on something. So it was just like very heavy communication. Like I had some like sit down and red line a contract, but usually I was just in meetings all day. Like, all right, the talent wants this, the manager wants this, the agent wants this. How can I bring us all in the room? How can I get this to have common understanding? You know, what do I need to say in this email, in this conversation? So it was just so communication heavy that like writing a book and like communicating to an audience so that they could like understand potentially complex things in a way that they could break down just felt like a natural extension of my skill set. And I think a lot of people do themselves a disservice because they don't call themselves the right thing. Like I was a lawyer, but really I was a master communicator and storyteller and problem solver, you know? So when I think about those things, I'm like, I can do lots of different things under that umbrella. Law, being a lawyer is just one way that I could express having those skills. So it's still, I still feel like I'm under the same umbrella. So it doesn't really feel super different to me, even though it probably sounds different to
other people. It does. That's a fascinating way to look at it. The actual work of being an attorney, did it match what you expected when you were in law school?
I think that I was profoundly not, I actually wasn't lucky. I was very intentional because I knew what I wasn't willing to do. So there was a lot of opportunities that I turned down. I didn't go to a firm. I never worked at a firm. I never did had a role that felt traditional. Like my internships were at MTV and Disney. Then I was at PBS, creative artist agency, then like a female startup, FabFitFun. So none of my experiences, I think, probably even mirrored or matched what other attorneys, you know, have done in their path. And again, I was very intentional about that. So that's like, for me, I'm like, even having like a dream job in quotation marks as an attorney, where I'm kind of like, you know, I had a lot of power early on. I'm working with like cool celebrities from like LA to whoever else, and Eva Longoria, like even doing all that stuff, I was like, this is cool, but like, I'm not really trying to do this anymore. So yeah, I don't know that I didn't have a lot of expectations in law school because I knew that I didn't know what to expect. Like I can't, my very first day at Disney, my boss asked me, you know, what questions do you have? And I was like, I don't even know enough to have a question. I'm just, I don't know anything. I'm here to learn. Let me watch a little bit and then I'll ask questions as they arise. So,
yeah. So that's really cool. You know, during one of the breaks, I was telling you that the college students that I interact with through teaching, many of them are seniors and they don't know what they want to do. And so my perception is that students, my message, I'll put it this way. The messaging I got all along when I was a kid from my parents was essentially at 18, you'll go to college and we'll support you, or you go and you need to figure out how to support yourself. Mm-hmm. I never got the messaging that you will like what you do or that what you do may be some expression of who you are, so to speak. And so I got lucky because my first choice, engineering, I loved it. And then with this kind of my interest in people, I gravitated towards people stuff. And now doing therapy, I'm extremely blessed to be able to do what I'm passionate about, which is helping people and through the therapy process. So the business that you co-founded, the Auditorium Museum, tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Auditory Museum is a storytelling company. Like, we help and provide platforms for people to like tell their stories. And again, I feel like that has always been the broader umbrella of like what I'm passionate about and what I excel at. So we have a card game where we are actually selling right now. They're called Like You Cards. You can buy them on our website, www.likeyoucards.com. I founded the company with two of my very close peers, Michael Nelder Henderson and Brian Taylor, and we all kind of have this mutual passion together. So you can read more about us on like our actual Auditory Museum page. We have two separate pages. But the card game is a getting to know you card game that helps people who, you know, may know each other but don't actually spend time with each other anymore to learn each other's stories, or have never met and are looking for ways to connect on a deeper level. We've had it called like the ultimate icebreaker. And it's a mixture of like fun questions and then like more serious questions. So it's been really cool just as a person who loves storytelling, pushing a product that's helping other people tell their stories.
I was about to say that sounds very therapeutic. A lot of the work I do, especially with couples, there's some common trends with couples and relationships. And essentially one of the things I'm always looking out for there's no conversation. Couples end up just talking about logistics, or if they have kids, everything's centered around the kids. And so I find myself giving homework assignments, and it sounds very similar to what Like You Cards are, because when you've known someone for so long, you think you know everything about them, and that is a killer of conversation and getting to know you. And if you're lucky in a relationship, getting to know your partner or spouse is an ever-evolving evolution. I like this. I'm gonna have to pass these out to my clients.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what you think. We call it the game with no rules because I think things have too much structure in this world and we don't give ourselves the freedom and creativity to play. But we also have like lots of suggested ways to play on the website for people who are like, I need rules. So I'd be interested to hear how you use it. And we've had teachers use them as like icebreakers for school or like writing prompts and stuff.
That's very cool. You know, in storytelling, you know, while you're talking about it, the light bulb went off. And I think storytelling, especially no matter where you are, and you probably already know this, but is a very effective way to get to know people. And to let them get to know you. And it, you know, I was thinking about my time, in corporate America at P&G, and so many of the really effective leaders were good storytellers. And they're authentic. And so, some of the other podcasts I listen to, and not that I'm plugging them, but, Snap Judgment, Risk. There's also a storytelling feature to it. And so it can be a very bonding experience telling stories. So that's really amazing. That's awesome work. What are some of the, most creative kind of clients or customers you've had in terms of helping them, do storytelling?
Yeah, it's been interesting. We weren't expecting to be working with like teachers. It wasn't our intention. But you know, kind of getting into that space and having just feedback from teachers, like, you know, social emotional learning is a buzzword right now. We're trying to find what are better ways to like build trust in the classroom, and, you know, foster communication that's more than just education, like, you know, indoctrination, giving information, etc. So just having teachers say that it's been like super helpful, that was kind of unsurprising, but also been a really cool lane. I would say like high school and college professors, not necessarily, there's nothing inappropriate, but like some of the questions, like, do you believe love is a feeling or a choice? Maybe not a 10-year-old is going to want to sit and think through that type of question. So that's been super interesting. And I've actually had feedback from people that played the game like months ago before it was even released, and we were still kind of like figuring out questions and getting the prototype right, that have come back and been like, we've played that game and my life changed. Like, I made a huge change in my life. I realized this about myself, or I started a business, and it's so crazy. Like, I felt like I've always loved getting to know people's stories and having like the power of noticing the power of conversation and what it can do. But it was so cool to know that I'd like created a product where people were actually like having breakthrough from playing this game.
You know, it's very, very interesting, because there's a whole approach to therapy called narrative therapy, that it's centered around storytelling, and it's a very effective way to help people retell their stories. So this is awesome. So that was my guest today, Kiara Amani Williams. She is the host of the podcast Sworn Testimonies, author of the upcoming book, Therapy Isn't Just for White People, and co-creator of Like You Cards. Now, you can order these cards and probably get a copy of her book at her website, which is kiaraamani.com. Thank you, Kiara, for being on the show today.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you. This is great.
Toby@paradigmradioshow.com. You can find archive shows and additional details about guests of the show at the show's website, www.paradigmradioshow.com. You can follow weekly 1-minute insight posts on the show's Instagram and Twitter feed at Paradigm Radio Show. For archived episodes, you can find episodes wherever you subscribe to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You, is brought to you by Jenkins Professional Services and Hype Media Global.
Thank you for tuning into Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You with Toby Jenkins. Join us again.